Pastor Dave Rolfe says a mere greeting as people come and go from church can really be a blessing.
Just by you greeting people after our worship and before the study, do you understand how much that can mean to someone? I've heard testimonies of people whose lives were changed because they went to church and they felt alone and someone made them feel welcome. Someone just gave them a hug and smiled at them and introduced themselves, and how that made all the difference in the world to them. And that's something that requires skill. It's something that requires somebody who's wise and sensitive. Oh, if you put somebody who's a total goofball in the position of being the first person that you meet, they can mess everything up, acting all weird and offensive, and they can turn you off completely. So this was a job that required wisdom.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hand. Instrument I play, wake up my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
The many different ways we can serve is very exciting. The potential is limited only by our imagination and God's calling, because it's the Lord behind our service. So the impact of your ministry may go deeper and reach further than perhaps you even realize. Case in point, the Levitical musicians. More on that in a moment, but first let me welcome you to today's broadcast. This is The Balanced Word with Pastor Dave Rolfe. We join Pastor Dave in 1 Chronicles chapter 25 today. It's there we learn of musicians prophesying with their instruments.
We listen to great Christian music and we know the lyrics, and therefore it speaks to our head. But it might be that the notes between the lyrics, it might be just that a melody or a particular rhythm is something that could speak to us in a way that God wants to get through to us. That may sound too ethereal for you. If so, blow it off. I just think it's interesting. And all these different instruments that were involved, the cymbals and stringed instruments and harps, for the service of the house of God. These instruments were serving God. During worship tonight, I was noticing, like, Frank, who was doing percussion back here, check these instruments out. It's really, like, I can't make any kind of a cool noise out of him, but, like, he has that thing going on, and then, like, you got this whole thing, and there's a wrench that he hits a triangle with, and I'm looking, this thing. Look, I don't know how you do it, but, like, he can make all these weird noises with all of this stuff, and it's like, you know, I could look at those things and mess around with them and have a good time, but it takes some experience, it takes some effort in order to really have it fit in with the worship of God. And, you know, we often think, oh God, I hope you, as we're singing praises to you, I hope you hear these lyrics. You're going to love these words. You know, frankly, I don't think God is all that impressed with the best words we can come up with. But just think, God might just be going, whoa, listen to that doingy, doingy sounding thing, you know? And appreciating that he created the capacity to make that kind of sound, that he created the ability to make something that affects your ear in that way. And if you think about how fearfully and wonderfully that we are made, and how it is that God can create so many different ways of touching us musically. Beyond that, think of all the times that music has spoken to you, that God has used it. It really wasn't necessarily the lyrics, but the whole package of music that God's created is something that I think is interesting. I believe it blesses him, and we shouldn't be surprised that it blesses us. Just a simple thing like music, played skillfully, dedicated to the Lord, and what a it was important enough that they had all these guys that was their job. That was their ministry, to just play instruments for God. Now, I remember years ago, I'll never forget it, at Calvary Chapel, the band Love Song was big at the time, and a guy, John Mailer, he's about this tall, and he was a drummer, just got saved, and he was a top session drummer. Well, he joined Love Song, but of course, in those days, you couldn't have drums in church, so he would play with Love Song on the bongo drums and sit there, and one time Pastor Chuck said to him, John, I heard that you were a drummer, and John said, well, you know, yeah, my BC days. And Chuck goes, well, where are your drums? He said, well, they're in storage. And he said, why don't you come this Monday night and play a drum solo? And John was like, what? A drum solo? Yeah, that was the night Chuck would do his Revelation study. He goes, come and play a drum solo. And John said, it was like Moses telling you to play a drum solo. It's like, oh, you know. And he had his full drum set, double basses, all these cymbals, everything set up. And he played about a 20-minute drum solo that was one of the most amazing things I've ever heard on a drum before. It was just like, whoa. And there were no words. And yet he was doing it under the Lord. And at the end, people were going crazy. And Johnny had this stubby little finger that looked like a Vienna sausage. And he was holding it up and just giving glory to the Lord. And after that, when Love Song would play, John would do like a 15-minute drum solo somewhere mixed up into the concert. And it was a lesson. It was a stretch for everyone to realize that God's not just about, okay, go through propositional truth. But God could sit there and listen to somebody play the drums and say, I'm pleased because you're offering that up to me. And so they had a concept of that in the Old Testament. There are some people today who don't get it. There are some churches today that don't even believe that we should have musical instruments at all. They feel like that's a wrong thing. But obviously in the Old Testament and the Psalms, it was a major function and should be for us as well. Chapter 26, the gatekeepers, these were basically the guys who were the ushers. It was an important task for them to perform because they decided who was able to come in and who wasn't. They also greeted people and made sure they had the right sacrifice. They could encourage the people as they would come in. It was basically a lot of what an usher does nowadays. And so these guys were divided up of the Kohathites, which is again, or Korahites. And these were guys who were Levites as well. And it says that they were, like verse 6, they were men of great ability. Verse 7 says they were able men. Verse 8, able men with strength for the work. Verse 12, they had duties just like their brethren to serve in the house of the Lord. And they, as they began to cast lots for who was going to do what, in verse 14 it says they cast lots for his son Zechariah, a wise counselor. Now, as they picked the gatekeepers, this was a big deal. And I believe that today, those who are the welcome people at church and those who are the ushers fulfill a crucial role in the body. And even if you're not one officially, just by you greeting people after our worship and before the study, do you understand how much that can mean to someone? I've heard testimonies of people whose lives were changed because they went to church and they felt alone and someone made them feel welcome. Someone just gave them a hug and smiled at them and introduced themselves and how that made all the difference in the world to them. And that's something that requires skill. It's something that requires somebody who's wise and sensitive. Oh, if you put somebody who's a total goofball in the position of being the first person that you meet, they can mess everything up, acting all weird and offensive, and they can turn you off completely. So this was a job that required wisdom. It required spiritual people who would be sensitive to the Lord and then perform their duty as if it's a skill, not as if it's like, oh, somebody has to do it. Here's your bulletin. Glad you're here. But it's a ministry that they took seriously. They listed it actually before the accountants that we see later on in the chapter and before all the people who would actually perform the sacrifices. What an important role it is when we're in a position to represent God in any capacity, but especially when we're the first person they see or the first opportunity that they have. And it might be here sometimes on Sunday morning, it's just people who are offering or helping with the donuts and things like that. Other people who just happen to be standing around in the parking lot, and then greeters at the door and the people handing out the bulletins and the ushers as you come in here. They looked on that as being a heavy responsibility with serious requirements. It's something that was a ministry as unto the Lord and an honor, really, something that they really appreciated. And so they had duties and all of their gatekeeping. Call your attention to verse 18. I often tell people that this is my life verse. In the King James Version, it says, at the Parbar westward, four at the causeway and two at Parbar. The New King James, as for the Parbar on the west, there were four on the highway and two at the Parbar. I don't know what it means, but I just like that verse. I once had it printed up on about 1,000 pins and gave them out to people. People look at it, but there it is, my life verse. Then he goes, beginning with verse 20, into the Levites who were in charge of the financial things, the treasures of the house of the Lord. over the treasuries of the dedicated things, all of the things that had been given to the Lord. And it says in verse 22, the sons of Jehieli, Zetham, and Joel, his brother, were over the treasuries of the house of the Lord. Shebuel was overseer of the treasuries. Verse 26, Shelomith and his brethren were over all the treasuries of the dedicated things which King David and the heads of fathers' houses, the captains over thousands and hundreds, and the captains of the army had dedicated. And verse 28, they had dedicated every dedicated thing. It was under the hand of Shelomith and his brethren and so on. Through the end of the chapter, all of these guys were taking care of everything that was dedicated, taking care of all the treasures, the gold and silver and all that was going to be a part of the temple and all the things that were there just for the sustenance of the body. A couple of interesting things about this, first of all, is that they saw this as something that was a spiritual duty. They didn't see it as something carnal. Also, they saw it as something that was an honor and an important thing to do, just to take care of the financial needs of the people. But notice this, that it was these a special category of Levites who were doing it. And one thing that that shows is that the king and the administrators and the governors and everyone else who were in positions of leadership didn't have their hand in the till. And it's one of the reasons why we try to keep money as separately as possible from, we have several different people who are accountable when our offering is taken on. Since we have a pulpit here, I should have taken an offering tonight too, but you'd think it was Sunday morning. But there are certain people who take the offering, other people who count it. It's double counted, taken to the bank by other people. The bank statement is gone over by someone else. The tithe records are put in and are kept confidential. So that here I am, I'm the pastor of the church. I have no idea what anybody gives. I don't have a way. I don't know a password to get on the computer. All I do in order to hold everyone responsible is I get a financial statement, which is something that any of you are welcome to see anytime you want. And the board members get this every month, emailed to them as well. But it shows every penny we spend, and it shows how much money we're taking in, but it doesn't show individually who gives what and all those sorts of things. And I never, well, one time I made a deposit, I think when Kenny was out of town. But other than that, we try to keep a separation. And it's not because I don't trust myself. You know, because when I was at Calvary Costa Mesa, I was making deposits of $60,000 or $70,000 regularly. And trust me, we haven't had a deposit like that. I trust myself, but just to be above reproach, it's just a good idea, as they did. It's not that, you know, that David was going to abscond with the money or the Levite, you know, the head Levites would or something. It's just let different people have different responsibilities. The Apostle Paul, when they were taking up an offering for Jerusalem, it says that they picked a guy who had a great reputation and another guy to go with him, and they carried all the money just so that it didn't look bad. Paul didn't take the money and stick it in his pocket. He didn't take it and go, oh, I'll watch this for you guys. It's just not the way they did it, just for appearance's sake. And it's important for us to maintain that kind of integrity. And so if you know that somebody's stealing from this church, it means about 12 people have to get really compromised in order to make it happen. And so it's not going to happen. It's not that I think it would happen anyway. It's that the Bible teaches that these things should be done with care. And that's all that they're really saying here. Chapter 27, now we shift from the Levites to other people and their responsibilities. And here in chapter 27, we see how the people were divided up militarily and then later more politically. And so the captains were listed there in the first 15 verses. And then beginning with verse 16, the leaders of all the tribes, and they were counted. Now look down in verse 23. It alludes to something we just looked at last week. It says in verse 23, but David did not take the number of those 20 years old and under, because the Lord had said he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heaven. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, began a census, but he did not finish, for wrath came upon Israel because of this census, nor was the number recorded in the account of the Chronicles of King David. David was numbering the people. It says that Satan put him up to it, but it also back before says that God put him up to it. But the whole thing is, he was numbering the people for the wrong reason. He wanted to see how strong are we. We were talking this week with was talking with some guys about how, and some churches still do this, but not many, but back in the day when I was a little kid, it was very common for the church to have a board up in the front of the church. And if you went to church when you were a kid, you might remember it. It had how many people came to Sunday school, how much offering we took in, how much money in the building fund, how much in the missions fund. And it was, and sometimes some churches would, I remember in the church I was in when I was a kid, they were raising money for a gymnasium, and so they had a thermometer, and they needed $100,000. And so the thermometer was moving up as people would put pledges in to promise to give money for the gymnasium. And I remember how excited they were when the thermometer finally hit 100,000. Now, I don't think they would have been as excited if they knew that between my brother and I, about 70,000 of those pledges were between the two of us. We just liked watching the thermometer go up, so we put in bogus pledges. But David was getting into that kind of it took him a long time to build that gym, too. But David was getting into this kind of a deal where it was like, let's see how strong we are. It happens all the time when pastors get together. You go to pastors' conferences. Nobody wants it to be their first question, but they always want to know, so how many people are in your church? About what size is your church? And this whole competitive sort of thing that just makes God sick. But, you know, here he is saying that that plague that came was because they started to do it. And notice the problem, because the Lord had said, verse 23, that he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heavens. So God was saying, hey, I'm going to do more for you than you can ever ask or think. So why do you need to count people? Why do you need to look at what you have right now? I'm not through yet. And what I intend to do is going to be great. And you're going to be blessed. You'll see. You start to count. What you're doing really is you're beginning to analyze and question whether or not God is really in it, whether God's really going to do what he says he's going to do. Or you just say, you know what? I leave that up to God. We'll just do what we're going to do. Always feel the same way about the offering. I'm not, you know, I do look at the financials every week, and I know how much offering we get, and it's pretty consistent. But I don't sit and think, oh, no, we need more money. Because what we do instead, we adjust what we do based on how much money we have. Oh, it might be we could probably get more things done if I stumped for money a lot and put out different appeals and took pledges and all those sorts of things. But I'm not interested in doing something if God's not in it. So what we as a board do is we sit down and we see how much money we have and we decide how we're going to spend it. And ultimately, that's what trusting in God is. And so David got out of that mentality by having his eyes on something he wasn't supposed to have his eyes on. And as a result, they paid the price. And we saw that story last week. Notice down in verse 33. Well, beginning with verse 25, you have different people who had more political and personal leadership. Guys who were over the farms. And this was more of David's cabinet, kind of. And his advisors. And down near the bottom, there were counselors and wise men and scribes. And verse 33, you see Ahithophel was the king's counselor. And Hushai, the Archite, was the king's companion. After Ahithophel was Jehoiada, the son of Benaiah, then Abiathar, and Joab became general. Two interesting guys that we've heard about before. Ahithophel was a guy who had said his advice to David was so good that when he gave advice, it was like God was speaking. Incredibly wise man. But Ahithophel had a problem. He became very bitter against David. The reason he probably became bitter against David is because David was involved with a gal named Bathsheba, killed her husband Uriah, got Bathsheba pregnant and disgraced her. And Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. It lets you know how low David was at that point, that his most loyal counselor, he would take advantage of his granddaughter in that way and have his grandson-in-law killed. But Ahithophel turned against him and sided with David's son when Absalom was attempting to overthrow David and actually was successful in doing it. Ahithophel sided with him. At that time, Hushai, who was the king's companion, he was just there as a right-hand guy to David. Hushai came out to David out in the wilderness, and he was covered with dirt, it says, and David said, you don't want to be out here. This isn't a place for you to be. And he goes, no, you don't want to help you. And he goes, why don't you go back to Jerusalem and be a spy for me? That'll be better. So he was a guy whose job initially was just to be a friend to David, to just be there with him, to be his companion, to help him out. And so that's interesting.
Hey, thanks for joining us today for The Balanced Word with our pastor and teacher, Dave Rolfe. We're going through 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and stay with us for more teaching from Pastor Dave. These programs are available by podcast at thebalancedword.com. Again, thebalancedword.com. We'd also like to offer you Pastor Dave's Through the Bible series on a USB thumb drive for a gift of $20 or more. Go through the Bible with Dave by ordering this special series today. Call 949-362-7475 or go to thebalancedword.com. Your gifts help to make these shows possible on stations like this one all across the nation. So thank you for standing with us with either a one-time gift or ongoing monthly support. Donations can be made at thebalancedword.com or again call 949-362-7475. Have you seen Pastor Dave's one-minute messages? Watch and listen to those at thebalancedword.com and even join our mailing list so you can have them delivered to you each day. You can also watch them on Instagram or Facebook by following CC Pacific Hills. We'd love to have you join us for a Sunday service at Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel. Our service times on Sunday morning are now at 8 and 10. Directions and more information about the church can be found online at ccpacifichills.org. And you can watch our live stream there too, ccpacifichills.org. If we can pray for you in any way, we ask that you contact us through thebalancedword.com or call us at 949-362-7475. Now let's peek into 1 Chronicles chapter 28 for a minute or two.
Chapter 28, we learn again of the instructions that David gave to Solomon as to how to build the temple. And it says in verse 2, King David rose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brethren and my people. I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. And I had made preparations to build it." Notice, it says this several times throughout the accounts here and over in Samuel, that David, it was in his heart to build a house for God. We know that God had to tell him no, as he goes on to explain here. But it's interesting that God himself says, "David, since you had it in your heart, here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to build a house for you," promised his seed and everything. Now, a lot of times we want to do something for the Lord, but for some reason it just doesn't happen. It's just not very smooth. Notice that God looks at what you have in your heart to do. If you've intended to do it and you fall on your face and it doesn't work, then God still says, you know, you had it in your heart. And that's what counts. It's the heart that counts. And so, again, here, that was the case with David. But God said to me, verse 3, "You shall not build a house for my name because you have been a man of war and have shed blood." Now, this wasn't accounted earlier. Samuel's account of this doesn't mention it, but here it is as David himself shares this, that God told him not only, "No, you can't build me a house," but he said, "One of the problems is you're a warrior, and I want a man of peace to be involved in this thing." But he said, "However, the Lord God of Israel chose me above all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. For he has chosen Judah to be the ruler," that is the tribe of Judah. Someone would always reign from their tribe. "And of the house of Judah, the house of my father. And among the sons of my father, he was pleased with me to make me king over all Israel." So he says, you know, God chose me as king. And even though, you know, I didn't get to do what I wanted to do for God, God wanted to emphasize that he wanted to do something for me. And so that's what he did. Now he said to me in verse 6, "It is your son Solomon who shall build my house and my courts. For I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever, if he is steadfast to observe my commandments and my judgments as it is this day." Now, if you remember back in the passage when this happened, God made this great promise to David. And he said, "I'm going to build you a house." And he said, "From your son Solomon, I'm going to set up the throne, and he's going to build the temple." But then he began to talk about how his house would be propagated forever. And then he was prophesying concerning Jesus, and ultimately the thing of, "I'll be a father to him, he'll be a son to me," is probably a reference to Jesus himself, the coming Messiah. But here, all he can see is this is Solomon. Now, something else that David couldn't completely see is that ultimately, biologically, Jesus didn't come from the seed of Solomon. He came from Solomon's brother, Nathan. Now, his legal right to rule, to be king, went through Solomon. Because you trace through Solomon in Matthew chapter 1, and you see that Joseph, the adoptive father of Jesus, was from the line of Solomon, connected to David. And so, legally, David inherited the right from his adoptive father to be the king. But in Luke chapter 3, where it has the genealogy of Mary, it shows that Jesus also was biologically traced to David.
We'll finish up First Chronicles tomorrow on The Balanced Word with Pastor Dave Raw, a presentation of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel and online at thebalancedword.com.
Wake up, my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands and the instrument I play.